My name's David Shepherd. I'm director of this, the Humanities Research Institute, or HRI, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you all to the latest in the series of inaugural lectures that are hosted by the HRI. Now, these lectures, as I always point out, are intended to offer opportunities for recently appointed professors in the arts and the humanities to spell out their vision for their the development of their subject, and thereby to bring the excellence of humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience, both within the university itself and beyond. In order to ensure as wide an audience as possible and as great an impact as possible for this evening's lecture, it will, as is our usual practice, be recorded and made available as a podcast on the HRI's website as soon as possible, so you will be able to listen again. Now, this is the first of a number of lectures in the 2008-09 academic year. And that's a year that will see departments in the newly renamed Faculty of Arts and Humanities moving closer together in this, the Jessop quarter of the university campus. And we're very much hoping that this greater proximity to one another and to the HRI will lead to more sustained and productive intellectual exchanges between departments within and indeed beyond the boundaries of the faculty itself. Inaugural lectures, I think, have an important contribution to make to this process, and we're very much looking forward to hearing over the coming months from colleagues in the School of Modern Languages and Linguistics, the Department of Philosophy, and the School of English Literature, Language and Linguistics. And indeed, that school is the academic home of this evening's lecturer, Professor Sue Owen. Sue came to the University of Sheffield in 1994. Before this, she taught at the University of Leeds, from where she holds the degrees of MA, 1987, and PhD, 1992. She's a distinguished specialist on restoration drama, on which she's published two monographs, Restoration Theatre and Crisis, published by OUP in 1996, and Perspectives on Restoration Drama, published by Manchester University Press in 2002. She's also the editor of a collection entitled Companion to Restoration Drama, which appeared with Blackwell in 2002. Given such productivity, there's also a whole series of articles and chapters. There was nothing surprising or dramatic about Sue's elevation to a personal chair in January last year. The deputy headship of school that Sue also holds is something that she might consider a less welcome, if no more unsurprising, reward for academic excellence. Now, everything I've told you so far is in the public domain on the School of English website. But introductions such as this traditionally contain information less easily accessible, often because their subjects are not exactly anxious to have it widely known. I suspect, anticipating the probability that I'd be looking to turn up from conversations with colleagues and friends, one or two interesting nuggets, Sue herself very helpfully provided me with an extensive, nay, exhaustive, biobibliographical document about herself. Now, while it was very thoughtful and sensible of Sue to provide me with such a rich source of things that I might wish to mention, it was perhaps somewhat less prudent for her to draw my attention at one point to something that would be better left unmentioned, in the context of an event attended by members of the lecturer's family. To which my response is to adapt slightly by changing the gender of the addressee the words of one of Afra Behn's characters, Alonso in Abdelaza or The Moor's Revenge. Madam, you're too partial to be judge in this and shall not give your voice. Now, there might appear to be a huge gulf in time and in genre between Afra Behn and the other subjects of Professor Owen's research on restoration drama and the subject of her lecture this evening, the sociologist Richard Hoggart, best known, of course, for his 1957 book, The Uses of Literacy, Aspects of Working Class Life. But at this point, I think we should follow the injunction of E.M. Forster that Hoggart used as the title of his 1971 BBC Reith Lectures, Only Connect. And we could do worse in this process than to begin with another gap in time, this time between Sue Owen's completion of her first degree at Oxford in 1977 and her MA 10 years later at Leeds, back in the north, albeit on the wrong side of the Pennines from her native St Helens, which she'd left at the age of 10. During this 10-year hiatus, Sue, and here I quote from her document, held a variety of jobs, from low-grade civil servant to school teacher to adult education tutor in a wide variety of contexts, including the Women in the Coalfields Communities Project in Castleford after the 1984-5 miners' strike. Since such political engagement was accompanied by an abiding interest in the relationship between literary culture and politics, it was natural that the focus of her MA course on the English Civil War, or what as a student in the Soviet Union I learned to call the bourgeois revolution, should lead her to consider what happened to literary culture and radical thought following the restoration of the monarchy. Moreover, as she writes, at a more gut level, I felt there were certain parallels between living in Thatcher's Britain and the period I was studying, specifically the experience of the memory of a radical past in a more reactionary present, a younger generation in a fraught relationship with their more radical forebears. It was this interest in contemporary working class culture that led Sue back to Hogarth, whose Uses of Literacy had made a profound effect on her, impression on her in the 1970s, as indeed she knew it had on her father and her uncle Edward. Giving her a sense that, I quote again, in working on restoration drama, I had in a sense been hiding from myself. Now Sue's work on Hogarth, her teaching no less and no less importantly than her research, has been in large measure driven by the fact that the University of Sheffield Library now holds Hogarth's papers. In 2006, she organised a major international conference on Hogarth, to which he himself contributed, alongside such figures as David Lodge, Stuart Hall and Stefan Collini. This was a conference, however, at which these big names were joined by representatives of organisations ranging from UNESCO to the WEA, and indeed by relatives and friends of Hogarth and members of the wider community. This year, 2008, has seen the publication of two volumes that Sue has edited and to which she has also made substantial contributions: Richard Hogarth and Cultural Studies, published by Palgrave, and Rereading Richard Hogarth, Life, Literature, Language, Education, published by the Cambridge Scholars Press. In the years to come, these will be followed by numerous further projects, including a book-length synthesis of Hogarth's ideas and an evaluation of their contemporary importance, a special exhibition, and a new edition of the Uses of Literacy that will draw on material held here in Sheffield's library. For Sue, one of the most important features of that 2006 conference was that in an unusual fusion of the personal and the academic at such an event, it was attended by members not only of Hogarth's family, but of her own. The same is true, less unusually for an occasion of this nature, of this evening's lecture. And it's my pleasure to extend an especially warm welcome to Sue's husband, John, her parents, Fernley and Ray, her twin daughters, Alice and Jenny. Thank you very much for coming. As I indicated earlier, it was anticipation of this family presence that led Sue to suggest that certain things might best be left unmentioned in my introduction. Well, there aren't that many ways in which I resemble Oscar Wilde, but one of the two that I can think of is that, like him, I can resist everything except temptation. Yet, if this makes you anxious, Sue, don't worry, I'm going to quote Ben again. Your fears are idle, blow them into air. For I'm sure that neither your family nor the rest of the audience will be particularly scandalised by the juxtaposition to which you yourself drew my attention. In 1996, Sue published an article in which she attempted to get to grips with scientific theory as a means of addressing what she sensed was the misuse of such theory by literary theorists, particularly when it came to their application of theory to working class culture. The title of this article is Chaos Theory, Marxism and Literature. Might there be some link, only connect, remember? Might there be some link between this newfound interest in chaos and the fact that in 1997, but she must have begun to organise it considerably before, Sue hosted an interdisciplinary conference entitled Drink, Drinkers and Drinking Places in Literature. Proof, not too strong a term in this context, I think, proof that this was not merely a passing interest was provided by the appearance in 2000 of the edited collection, wonderfully titled A Babel of Bottles, and of subsequent articles on drink in literature. Well, the HRI and the School of English have clubbed together this evening for there to ensure that there's a modest babel of bottles out there in the breakout space after the lecture, and we very much hope that you will join Sue for a glass or two of wine, or, if you truly fear chaos, water or orange juice. Before that, it's time for Professor Sue Owen to address us on the subject of Schools of English in Contemporary Society, the importance of Richard Hogarth. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I decided to take as my starting point tonight Richard Hogarth's own appointment to a chair at Birmingham University in 1961. And I'm going to look at Hogarth's own inaugural lecture, which was entitled Schools of English and contemporary society. I believe Hoggart's inaugural lecture speaks to us today, and I think it also speaks for us, or for those of us in schools of English, at a time when our role is being questioned and our vision needs defining and defending. In his life and times, Hoggart makes some remarks, quite ironic remarks, about the way men behave on becoming professors, to quote. "Still above what I call the base layer," the base layer is a layer of good sense and good intentions, "gravitas tends to be common. It is as though many people, having acquired the extraordinarily luminous title of professor, subcutaneously feel that in physiognomy and style they have to live up to their own favoured inner portraits. The hair lengthens well over the ears. A well-thumbed pipe succeeds cigarettes. The voice takes on depth and the walk weight." But this is what he feels about his own appointment to a chair. Quote, "I was talkative enough in Senate, but I rarely felt I looked the part. The woman who helped 2 half-days a week in our Birmingham house thought that too. He doesn't look like a professor, she told Mary. He looks more as if he runs a pub." This feeling of not quite fitting in recalls a scholarship boy or working class intellectual about whom Hoggart had written in The Uses of Literacy. These are the things he says. He is at the friction point of two cultures. "This kind of person belongs now to no class, usually not even to what is called, loosely enough, the classless intelligentsia. He is usually ill at ease with the middle classes because with one side of himself he does not want them to accept him. He mistrusts or even a little despises them. He is divided here as in so many other ways. With one part of himself he admires much he finds in them, a play of intelligence, a breadth of outlook, a kind of style. He would like to be a citizen of that well-polished, prosperous, cool book-lined and magazine-discussing world of the successful, intelligent middle class, which he glimpses through doorways or feels awkward among on short visits, aware of his grubby fingernails. With another part of himself, he develops an asperity towards that world. He turns up his nose at its self-satisfactions, its earnest social concern, its intelligent coffee parties, its suave sons at Oxford, and its Mrs. Miniverish or Mrs. Ramsey-ish cultural pretensions. He is rather over-ready to notice anything which can be regarded as pretentious or fanciful, anything which allows him to say that these people do not know what life is really like." I think that's spot on. But if Hoggart spoke for the sufferings of working class intellectuals, he also represented their triumph. When he arrived to take up his chair at Birmingham, he joined a department of English which included novelists and critics Malcolm Bradbury and David Lodge, who were then junior lecturers. David Lodge has written of his excitement on Hoggart's appointment. Quote, "Richard Hoggart came to Birmingham when he was a kind of hero to the liberal left-leaning literary intellectuals, to the first generation university graduates like myself who were increasingly staffing universities, especially provincial ones, and to the first generation students they were teaching. He was the scholarship boy as star." Hoggart was already famous as the author of The Uses of Literacy. As David has already said, this was a seminal work of cultural criticism. In this book, he had been the first literary critic to take the working class seriously and to extend the parameters of literary criticism to include popular culture. The Uses of Literacy had put the working class on the cultural map. And Hoggart differentiated between what was offered by the popular providers, as he called them, the media, popular fiction, adverts and so on, and the resilient culture of working class people themselves. He offers a searing indictment of the specious populism and banality of popular newspapers and magazines, the fake pally patter of the tabloids and of adverts aimed at ordinary people. and the literary flatness and moral emptiness of much popular fiction. This picture shows the original typescript, now in the Hoggart Archive here at Sheffield. On this page, Hoggart is discussing the limits as well as the creative possibilities of gangster novels. On this page, Hoggart has added in handwriting and by cut and paste a report from a radio company. This deals with a programme on Radio Luxembourg. I don't know who remembers Radio Luxembourg. It was a pirate radio station. I remember it well. But he's trying to make the point that most mass entertainments are in the end what D.H. Lawrence calls anti-life. They are full of corrupt brightness, of improper appeals and moral evasions. Those who know the uses of literacy may be surprised that the report from the radio company is there, because it isn't there in the published text. The book was originally called The Abuse of Literacy, and it contained analysis of specific named publications, such as reports from radio companies, such as the Daily Mirror, the novels of James Hadley Chase, and so on. Hoggart was shocked to get a letter from the publisher saying that the lawyers thought this was all libelous and the book could not be published. We can't show you that letter because we don't hold copyright in it. We only hold copyright in things written by Hoggart himself. Here's Hoggart's reply. All the correspondence is in the Hoggart archive. Hoggart, we can see, says it is a terrific shock. And in paragraph 4, I'm not sure if that's on the picture, he is puzzled to, that they object to what he sees as more or less pure literary criticism. To get the book published, he had to go through and substitute made-up examples of popular writing. He did this actually amazingly well. He was very good at writing popular, sensational gangster fiction. But he was a victim, basically, of 1950s censorship, and he did manage to get round it with these made-up examples, but it seems a pity that the close analysis of popular publications from the original didn't make it into the published version. We can see at the end of the letter that he refers to this as butchery. It's good that we can now see the original in the archive for the first time. The uses of literacy celebrated the resilient culture of working class people themselves and argued that working class people deserved better than much of what passed for popular culture. It argued that working class people were capable of complex cultural responses. And this created a basis for challenging the elitism of his predecessors such as T.S. Eliot and F.R. and Q.D. Leavis. Hoggart questioned these critics' views of the masses as passive recipients of a debased mass culture. Discussing in an interview Queenie Leavis's Fiction and the Reading Public, he observes, quote, "It's a classic text, but throughout it she treated romantic fiction as though she had a peg on her nose." She also made a fairly simple equation between what people read and what they become. "So I wanted to look at popular literature in a more inward way to show that a good bad book may bring out good impulses, or that people may bring to it things which are themselves almost unconsciously critical." Similarly, in his inaugural lecture at Birmingham in 1963, Hoggart advises humility about what ordinary people actually take from popular culture and popular art. He deplores commercialised popular culture, but not from a snooty perspective. It's the commercial aspect he objects to rather than the popular aspect. And even in part two of The Uses of Literacy, where he deplores what we would now call dumbing down, there are signs of a certain relish for popular culture and for aspects of popular fiction. In his inaugural lecture, he suggests that literary academics must engage with popular culture, and he adds, quote, "Perhaps no one should engage in this work who is not in a certain sense himself in love with popular art." So Hoggart distinguishes himself from what we might call Leavisite cultural elitism, and at the same time initiates an important mid-20th century shift from deploring popular culture to seeing it as a source of possible insight and inspiration. The uses of literacy had a massive impact beyond the confines of the academy. It was widely reviewed in the popular press as well as the academic press. It was translated into many languages. It was discussed on TV and radio. The Daily Herald called Hoggart an angry young man, and it printed a follow-up quiz inspired by his ideas and purporting to explore contemporary social attitudes. Hoggart made many guest broadcasts from 1957 onwards to talk about the effects of the modern media on the traditional working class. The book had an enormous impact also on generations of inquiring learners to whom its accessible style and its relevance to their own lives made it appealing. One of the last public appearances that Hoggart made was at the Ilkley Literature Festival, and John and I were there, and we saw a packed room of adults who had been adult learners standing up, and person after person testified to the influence that the uses of literacy had had on their lives. And these weren't academics, these were sort of self-taught adult learners. But the book also appealed because it spoke to its times. Stuart Hall makes this point, quote, "The publication of the uses of literacy had an enormous impact, in part for its for the intrinsic interest, quality and originality of its argument, in part because of its bearings on a wider discussion about the pace and direction of post-war social change. Hoggart's argument took its bearings from the broader debate about post-war affluence and what came to be known as working class embourgeoisement." And David Lodge locates the uses of literacy as a key work in a post-war literary shift, which he sees as more complex than the angry young man tag invoked by the Daily Herald. Hoggart, says Lodge, spoke for a generation of writers and intellectuals. For Lodge, uses provided a kind of moral and social justification for dealing truthfully and realistically with ordinary life, especially urban life. It encouraged young writers whose social backgrounds had nothing special, exotic or glamorous about them to write about their own experience. And for writers from the working class or from the lower middle class, Hoggart's assertion of the importance of the ordinary was very empowering. Playwright Alan Bennett, for example, remarks, quote, "It was reading Hoggart 40 years ago that made me feel that my life, dull though it was, might be made the stuff of literature." So, Hoggart came to Birmingham in 1961 with a bright reputation. The chapter of his life and times dealing with this appointment is called Great Hopes from Birmingham. What were these great hopes? Well, the great hopes centred around the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, which Hoggart founded at Birmingham. And he used his inaugural lecture to outline the thinking behind the new centre. His inaugural lecture was then published, as we can see there, this is all in the archive, in the Hoggart archive, as a University of Birmingham pamphlet under the title Schools of English and Contemporary Society, price 2 and 6, which I actually think is rather expensive. Hoggart started life as an adult education tutor, like Raymond Williams and Stuart Hall and other people at the cutting edge of the new cultural studies. Adult education had boomed after the Second World War in Britain. And Hoggart was prompted to study popular culture, partly by the questions asked by his adult education students about connections between literature and their daily lives. He had made such connections himself in the uses of literacy. And in his inaugural lecture, he challenges others in schools of English to follow his lead. He makes a case for widening the boundaries of English, because the new field of cultural studies was conceived of as within English at that time. And it is quite hard now to recapture the force of Hoggart's challenge to received wisdom about the loftiness and timelessness of English literature. Hoggart says that English, once again and finally, has to do with language, exploring human experience in all its flux and complexity. It is therefore always and finally in an active relation with its age, and some students of literature, many more students of literature than at present, ought to try and understand these relationships better. Schools of English, Hoggart argues, have a mission to engage with how language is being used in the world today, even if this means moving outside disciplinary boundaries. He admires the boldness of those who tackle interconnections between history, politics and the aesthetics of popular taste. He also makes connections between English literature and language, which not everybody was making at that time. And I think that all this is actually quite iconoclastic stuff in 1963. It may not seem so now, of course, but it was then. Hoggart is careful to situate his argument in the context of initial praise in the lecture for literary values and an assertion of the primacy of literary critical method. And this might just be a sop to the School of English which was employing him, but I don't think so. I think it goes deeper. Hoggart is not debunking literary criticism, but giving it a broader mission. A training in English, he thinks, encourages increased respect for the life of language and for the unpremeditated textures of experience. So the literary critic is uniquely fitted to expose debased uses of language by the persuaders and manipulators, when prose has its eye, he says, only slightly on the object and almost wholly on the audience. This is effectively a political stand. The second quotation on the slide. As it is, too many of us stay most of the time within our well-defined academic areas, but succumb easily to occasional invitations from the world outside. We do not, with sufficient confidence, separate ourselves from that world, nor sufficiently critically engage with it. By insisting on the difficult but responsible life of language and on the overriding importance of the human scale, we can try to do our part in resisting the unreal, unfelt, and depersonalised society. To me, this still seems pertinent. Hoggart wants literary academics to get out in the world, to engage with how language is actually being used, but in a critical rather than a passive or a populist way. The remit of the new cultural studies, as Hoggart envisages it in the lecture, is threefold. The first aspect is roughly historical and philosophical, another is again roughly sociological, and the third, which he says will be the most important, is the literary critical. The historical and philosophical approach includes the need to know more about the history of the cultural debate, along the lines pioneered by Raymond Williams in Culture and Society. And it includes a better definition of terms to avoid confused assumptions, what he calls the clash of undernourished generalisations and of submerged apologetics that takes the place of what should be a dialogue. Some people might call this work theoretical. It's gone on for the last 40 years, actually, without Hoggart's appeal for it having been recognised. His appeal remains topical as well, because I think that while some terms like highbrow, for example, and lowbrow are now discredited, other dubious terms that he questions, such as the common man or the masses, still have a certain regrettable currency, still need to be challenged. Hoggart's appeal for more philosophers to come into cultural studies has gone, as far as I know, completely unheeded. So there is still what he calls a cavalier creation of new little cultural patterns. I was trying to think of an example, and I think perhaps the angry young man movement might serve as well as any. The second sociological approach that Hoggart envisages for the new cultural studies would include attention to the background and rewards of writers and artists, the audience for different levels of approach, the opinion formers and their channels of influence, organisations for the production and distribution of the written and spoken word, including the impact of the paperback revolution, which, and what it means to see books as commodities, links between commercialisation and literary reputations, and finally, and this is the third passage on the slide, how little we know about all sorts of interrelations, about interrelations between writers and their audience, and about shared assumptions, about interrelations between writers and organs of opinion, between writers, politics, power, class and cash, about interrelations between the sophisticated and the popular arts, interrelations which are both functional and imaginative, and about how few foreign comparisons we have made. I actually think that that work, insofar as it's been undertaken at all, has been better carried out in relation to the early modern period than in relation to the 20th or 21st century, but that may be contentious. Hogarth insists throughout on the accuracy and historical specificity of the approach, and on the avoidance of schematism and specious generalisations. Those kind of sweeping generalisations are anathema to Hogarth. But at the same time, I think he draws a much bigger map there than he's often given credit for. He envisages cultural studies as a multidisciplinary project to build up an overall view of contemporary culture through attention to specifics. And this method of a dialectic between the particular and the general has not really been thoroughly grasped by his successors, in my view. And although some of the issues he outlines have been addressed, others remain comparatively unexplored. Excuse me. Hogarth reiterates that the third approach, the literary critical approach, will be the most important of all within cultural studies. And he explains why this is distinct from the sociological approach. And this is the final passage on the slide. Most important of all, the directly literary critical approach in cultural studies is itself neglected. Yet it is essential to the whole field. Because unless you know how these things work as art, even though sometimes as bad art, what you say about them will not cut deep. Here, we particularly need better links with the sociologists. It is difficult outside a seminar to use a literary critical vocabulary to talk about the quality of the imagination shown, or to discuss the effect on a piece of writing of various pressures. For instance, to talk about corner-cutting techniques, or linguistic tricks, or even, perhaps especially, about what tone reveals. All this needs to be analysed more, to be illustrated and enforced, and at all levels, not just in relation to the mass arts. Obviously, it'll be clear that there's a literary critical slant to this from which later cultural studies has not largely but completely departed. So Hogarth values literary critical method for its truth-revealing power. He values it for its ability to reveal tones and nuances. He values it for its ability to identify influence, for its ability to elucidate, to expose and to debunk. But always Hogarth insists on the quiddity of the literary or cultural object of study. The text is never to be read simply as historical evidence. It's always to be read from the inside out rather than from the outside in. And unsurprisingly, these disciplinary distinctions were not maintained in the way Hogarth envisaged them in cultural studies, especially after his departure from the centre. Although his influence was a lot stronger than some people have supposed. But the point is that the importance of Hogarth's initiative in founding the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies cannot be overstated. And what seems really extraordinary to me now is the resonance of Hogarth's initiative amongst what we might call the literati. Hogarth got funding for the new centre from Alan Lane of Penguin Books to the tune of £2,400 a year for 7 years. Chatto and Windus, who had published The Uses of Literacy, and the Observer newspaper topped it up to £2,500 a year for 7 years and a one-off payment of £500. This is in 1963, so that was a lot of money. And it enabled Hogarth to appoint a research fellow, Stuart Hall, who succeeded him as director of the centre. He also could appoint a secretary, he could buy books, he could pay speakers' expenses. And on top of that, foundations gave money for specific purposes. The Roundtree Memorial Trust, for example, gave a grant to enable a substantial study of the press, which was published as Paper Voices. Hogarth notes in his Life and Times, quote, "It was all very simple, unbusinesslike, and by today's standards in university administration, impermissible. But what is really extraordinary, I think, is not the unbusinesslike simplicity of it all, but the level of support from the wider community of press and publishing for the founding of a new centre for something they'd never heard of before." studies of popular culture. This tells us a lot about the conjuncture, I think, in 1963. I mean, it seems quite remarkable today when we're all scrapping over ever-diminishing arts funding. It really is not the unbusinesslike simplicity of it so much as the astonishing availability of financial support that strikes us. Alan Lane's support might be partly explained by the favour that Hoggart had done Penguin Books in 1960. I'm sure most people know about this. Hoggart gave key evidence at the trial of Penguin Books for publishing D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover in paperback. Hoggart is famous for calling Lady Chatterley's Lover a Puritan book. His evidence is widely acknowledged to have been central in leading to the acquittal of Penguin, and it led to widespread notoriety in the press, as we can see here. These are just a selection of articles from the Hoggart archive. I unfortunately couldn't find my favourite, which has the title Potty Prof. Actually, those articles are quite sensationalised. You can see the pictures of Hoggart there, though, looking very kind of Puritan himself in a way. This one's from The Guardian. This is a bit more serious. He looks incredibly sort of intellectual there. And I don't know if you can read what it says at the top, but it says, Mr. Hoggart is a short, dark, young, Midland teacher of immense scholarship and fierce integrity. And then underneath it says, Mr. Hoggart is a working class intellectual. And then finally, the hero among the witnesses was Richard Hoggart. And then the article starts, Richard Hoggart has become familiar with comments like these. Praise must be pleasant for someone who failed the equivalent of the 11 plus in 1930. So that's sort of praising with faint damns. And here's a nice one from the Leicester Mercury. Hoggart, at the time in 1960, still lived in Leicester. He was a senior lecturer at Leicester University. I think it's incredible. Here's a picture of Hoggart and his family. If anyone's interested, the guy with the glasses in his school uniform is Simon Hoggart, the Guardian journalist and radio presenter. And they've let Hoggart write it. It says by Richard Hoggart. They've actually let him write it himself, which shows, you know, the level of support in the local area for what he had done in testifying on behalf of Lady Chatterley. Well, Penguin. Anyway, what Hoggart did was very important because the acquittal of Penguin marked a watershed in public perceptions. It shifted cultural parameters. As Philip Larkin noted in his poem, sorry for those that know this too well almost, but it's a very famous quotation from Larkin's Annus Mirabilis. Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. So Hoggart really made an impact by being so key in the end of the Chatterley ban. He made an impact, of course, with the uses of literacy, and he made an impact now again with the founding of the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies. Because astonishingly, the pamphlet of his inaugural lecture was reviewed in the press. It was reviewed in the Times Literary Supplement, for example, and there's the review there, you can see it, it's in the archive, on the 17th of May 1963, and I haven't come across another example of someone's inaugural lecture being reviewed in the Times Literary Supplement. I'm willing to stand corrected if anyone else knows of one, but I don't know of one. And this anonymous review praises Hoggart and even calls him a nationally representative figure. It's sympathetic to his plea. This is what they say. This is their words, not Hoggart's. His plea that there should be some place in schools of English at universities for helping students to connect with what they are. Sorry, to connect what they are swatting at with what they live in. Hoggart would never have written so kind of inelegantly. And at the end of the article, which you can't actually see there, but you can sort of read it if you want in the archive, it says there is only one possible objection to Hoggart's plan for the new Centre for Cultural Studies, and it's this: the life of a university, like the life of a monastery, ought perhaps not to be more warmly merged with the life going on in the same city, the same nation around it. It ought to be more sharply separate than it is. During their university years, in other words, students ought not to be trying to live more fully in the present, but more imaginatively and objectively, not in the past, but in the perennial. But then it finishes, it doesn't end there, it finishes. Against this argument, there is Mr. E.M. Forster's famous injunction, only connect. And Mr. Hoggart's whole inaugural lecture, I'm still quoting, Mr. Hoggart's whole inaugural lecture could indeed be considered as a lively and improving sermon on that text. And David's kind of stolen my thunder a bit here, because as David said, Hoggart took the title Only Connect for his BBC Reith lectures on culture and communications in 1970. So, what can we learn from Hoggart? Have we got the balance right today between turning to popular culture and retaining a sense of distinctions? Have we perhaps gone too far? The idea of cultural value, the privileging of certain cultural products over other cultural products, has been problematised as elitist, and rightly so in some cases. But the wider public remains concerned about questions of value. We see this in debates about so-called dumbing down. We see it in every time there are comments in the press about the alleged decline in A-level standards and so on. Whatever we may think in the academy, the questions of value remain of vital interest to the public at large. Hoggart values popular culture, but he defends a non-elitist kind of intellectual discrimination. Why? Well, in order to arm ordinary people against the manipulations of the popular persuaders, the tabloids, the ad men, the purveyors of a commercial culture, which claims to be feeding them what they want, even though it really isn't. And I believe that recovery of Hoggart's ideas can point the solution to what has effectively become a crisis of values. Because questions of value for Hoggart can't be evaded. It is plain, says Hoggart, that behind almost any discussion today about the arts, and indeed about any of those areas of British culture with which I have been involved, lies the evaded question of value judgments. For Hoggart, the idea of value has to be defended because otherwise democracy is open to abuse. This is the second quotation on the slide. It is true that it is better to be free to find our own rules than to have them imposed by church or state. But it is precisely in these kinds of democracies that this openness is comprehensively abused by people with their own ulterior purposes. It does not lead to our being left alone, let alone unaided, to find our own beliefs. We are besieged by a mass of apparently conflicting but actually consonant voices, each peddling its own patterns of overt or more likely hidden beliefs. All of them, politicians, advertisers, tabloid newspaper hacks and many another, are interested parties. The ways of life they offer have overwhelmingly at their centre the notion that it's all a matter of taste and of changing taste, since that's what keeps the wheels of this kind of society turning. Openness becomes emotional promiscuity. Choice becomes whim. But underneath is a passivity, the acceptance of things as they are and are offered. A crucial aspect of the argument of the uses of literacy is that the so-called popular persuaders, and Hoggart thinks they all are similar in method, even if they differ in their particular ideology, that a crucial aspect is that they all exploit and graft themselves onto positive traditional working class values. So, for example, traditional working class openness becomes a shared passivity. Quote from the uses of literacy, above all you mustn't resist like a stone in the water, snagging the inchoate flow or make distinctions, unquote. Hoggart challenges this view that anything goes. He challenges the idea that you shouldn't be a snob or a spoilsport. He challenges the idea that high-mindedness or intellectual snobbery must be avoided at all costs and can't be distinguished from intellectual discrimination and critical stringency. For Hoggart, it is crucial to tackle this error in order to arm ordinary people against the manipulations of the popular persuaders and in order to challenge this tyranny of relativism that the popular persuaders exploit. So, in other words, the idea that no cultural products are better than any others becomes a stick to beat down any intellectual challenge. And Hoggart opposes those writers, whether they're intellectuals, whether they're in the media and so or whatever. He challenges those writers whose populist abandonment of critical value judgment disempowers the disregarded subgroups that they are ostensibly defending. The working class in particular, he says, is left defenceless and exposed as a kind of specious populism all too easily mutates into the argument that we may as well give them rubbish because that's all they want and that's all they're good for. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, that's not what Hoggart actually says. Associated with the idea of value and with the return to the idea of value is a sense of the renewed importance of literary texts within culture, because cultural studies until recently saw the demise of the literary as a fait accompli. That may shock some of us in schools of English, but I think it's true. And I also think it's true, and again this may be extremely contentious, that literary scholars have undermined literary value, the idea of literary value, from within the discipline, partly from laudable anti-elitist impulses and also aided by postmodern theory. But this leads us with no clear basis to argue for the value of the literary, even though the wider public has a clearer sense of the clearest possible sense of the value of the literary. We see this all the time in debates over the school curriculum, in debates about declining standard, in the popularisation of good books from preschool onwards, in the burgeoning of literary festivals, in the booming of literary prizes and so on and so forth, and literary events of one sort and another. I think it's a marker of the desire for a return to the literary within cultural studies that I, as a literary scholar, edited Richard Hoggart and Cultural Studies, which was published by Palgrave, in which all the contributors are from cultural studies. I'd like to also thank Bill Hughes for his excellent design of the cover of this, which was also used as the conference poster for the conference we organised on Hoggart in 2006. I think he's done a smashing job there. Now, a continuous thread running through that collection by cultural studies scholars is recovering the roots of Hoggart's critical practice in literary studies. I think almost fortuitously or coincidentally, they didn't collaborate on that. That just happens to be where they're all, not all, but where a lot of them are coming from. And why do they want to recover Hoggart's roots in literary studies? I think it's in order to rescue and renegotiate an idea of literary value which is more subtle, either than Leavisite elitism or than the populist backlash against it, which they realise has gone too far. And I think it may also, if I'm not presumptuous in saying this, that this collection may represent a somewhat modest contribution to a rapprochement between cultural studies and literary studies, which are fields obviously with overlapping interests and a lot of common goals. So I'm arguing, I suppose, that with Hoggart as exemplar, the literary can be shown anew to have a place within cultural studies and social analysis. Hoggart believed, quote, that great works of literature supremely embody the meanings within cultures, that they perceptively and honestly explore and recreate the natures of societies and the experiences of human beings within them, that great writing bears its meanings by creating orders within itself and so helps reveal the orders of values within societies, whether by mirroring them or by resisting them, and proposing, usually obliquely, new orders. And so the expressive arts, and especially literature, are guides of a unique kind to the value-bearing nature of societies. And Hoggart sees the working class in particular as armed and empowered through education, obviously, but also in particular through an encounter with good literature. Jonathan Rose bears this out. Jonathan Rose has written a magisterial survey of worker writers in a book called The Intellectual Life of the British Working Class. And Rose vindicates, I think, or Rose's work rather, and the numerous worker autobiographies that he has surveyed from the 18th century onwards, all bear out, all vindicate Hoggart's judgments that good literature empowers the working class. Rose cites self-taught workers from the 18th century onwards to show the value so-called high culture has had for the working class. This is to quote Rose, and it's on there. Again and again we find classic literature embraced by working people who thoroughly lacked literary education, unquote. Rose asks, quote, if the dominant class defines high culture, then how do we explain the passionate pursuit of knowledge by proletarian autodidacts? I actually think we could include Hoggart among those proletarian autodidacts, even though he got an education as a scholarship boy, because a lot of his learning was kind of self-acquired as well. He was kind of self-taught also. But anyway, he has a lot in common with them, in my opinion, but anyway. Rose continues, quote, if the classics offered artistic excellence, psychological insights, and penetrating philosophy to the governing classes, if, in fact, this kind of education equipped them to rule, then the politics of equality must begin by redistributing this knowledge to the governed classes. And David mentioned at the beginning my work in Castleford, which went on for a number of years in the 1980s, in the Women in the Coalfield Communities Education Project. And the first time I went along to one of those night classes, I sort of rather patronisingly said, no, we're going to value your culture. I'm not here to talk top down and to give you my learning. We'll talk about local history and what's going on for you. And they said, we don't want that. We want to know what you know. QED. Like Hoggart, Rose counsels caution against facile assumptions about what workers take from culture. And Rose stresses that workers have the power to transform and appropriate received messages. Rose quotes Charles Duncan. I bet nobody's heard of him. But anyway, he lived from 1865 to 1933, and he was one of the first working-class MPs. He was the founder of the workers' movement in the early 20th century. Charles Duncan invested all his spare cash in books. He promoted the creation of public libraries. He urged workers to read the ancient classics because he said that otherwise they would be at the mercy of the educated classes. And this is the quotation from Charles Duncan that Rose offers. It's on the slide. The unread man has a narrow outlook and easily goes astray. He is the sport of political tricksters and the tool for all knaves. And Hoggart would agree with this. And I think he would also endorse, probably, Rose's rather Arnoldian perception that, quote, far from reinscribing traditional ideologies, canonical literature tended to ignite insurrections in the minds of the workers. For Hoggart, as for many of the early self-taught worker intellectuals that I've just been talking about, and early worker activists and so on, public service is the duty of the intellectual. It flows from his conception of the intellectual's social and political role, that he has not lived in the ivory tower, he's engaged in society, he has striven for change from within. He spent 5 years as Assistant Director General of UNESCO. This, on the cover of this book, this is a collection called Rereading Richard Hoggart, which came out a few weeks ago. We can see a previously unseen photo of him, which was discovered in the UNESCO archives by Malcolm Hadley. And in addition, Hoggart has undertaken many activities in arts, culture, broadcasting and education. He's been director of Birmingham Repertory Theatre, member of the Albemarle Committee on Youth Services, member of the Pilkington Committee on Broadcasting, Reef Lecturer, Chair of the Broadcasting Research Unit, Vice Chair of the Arts Council, Chair of the Statesman and Nation Publishing Committee, Chair of the Advisory Council for Adult and Continuing Education, Member of the British Board of Film Classification Appeals Committee, and so on. Those are only a few examples, and material relating to all those cultural interventions is in the Hobbit Archive. The archive originally consisted of over 100 boxes of diverse material: photos, letters, diaries, typescripts, taped broadcasts, correspondence, press cuttings, all sorts of things. It's quite a rich research resource. Hoggart was also the first critic to take TV and radio seriously. He made a number of critical interventions about broadcasting, several books. His reflectures only connect. The Mass Media and a New Colonialism, Mass Media in a Mass Society, and so on. He also virtually wrote the Pilkington Report on Broadcasting, which was extremely influential in the late 60s. He was hated by both Margaret Thatcher and Mary Whitehouse, unsurprisingly. But he nevertheless strove to serve culture in the public sphere for several decades as an important extension of his ideas about the need for cultural quality. The impulse which has informed all Hoggart's activities in the public sphere is democratic and communitarian. He summarises his credo in the concluding volume of his Life and Times. I began this chapter with an image for the shape of my professional life after the publication of The Uses of Literacy. The picture of a single river breaking into many subsidiary streams. Yet the dispersal was in the forms of the activity, not in the types of interest. The Delta has had only four or five branches, and they all interconnect. Their common source is a sense of the importance of the right of each of us to speak about how we see life, the world. And so, the right to have access to the means by which that capacity to speak may be gained. The right also to try to reach out and speak to others, not to have that impulse inhibited by social barriers, maintained by those in power politically, or able to exercise power in other ways. So, the main currents of my interests have been the right of wider access to higher education, the need for wider access also to the arts as the most scrupulous explorations we can make of our personalities and relationships, and of the nature of our societies, and as a support to all this, the best uses of mass communications. So Hoggart's core beliefs have remained remarkably consistent. He may have had a great variety of social interventions, but underlying them all are these core beliefs. And also, I would argue, a stringent personal integrity. The man is the message. And it's this integrity, this idea of being true to oneself, which underpins his social vision. His vision for broadcasting, for example, rests on deceptively simple ideas about communication. First of all, with ourselves, and only secondly with others. And Hoggart's works tend to have titles like Only Connect, you can see there, possibly you can't see, I don't know, Speaking to Each Other, volumes 1 and 2. I mean, he's written over 24 books, but they all have titles, well, not all of them, but a lot of them have titles stressing dialogue. But the second reef lecture, there are six reef lectures, and they're all published in the volume Only Connect. And the second one is called Talking to Yourself. Oddly, perhaps. In this second reef lecture, Hoggart talks about writing for ourselves as a way of getting in touch. Getting in touch not only with other people, but also and first of all with oneself. If we are writing about anything important to us, we are both trying to speak to others and developing a relationship with ourselves. Finding a tone to talk with, that's a very Hogartian phrase, I think. Finding a tone to talk with begins with finding one that seems right to us and for us. Talking to others begins with talking to yourself and with being yourself in talking. Hoggart's ideas about broadcasting policy start from a belief in programme makers being free to be true to their own voice and vision. free to be diverse, but also free to make choices, free to recognise standards, and free to break from the tyrannies of relativism and populism, i.e. playing to the mass. Dramatists and producers must be imaginatively free within the technical possibilities and technological limits of the medium, obviously. They must be free to invoke new audiences, to take risks, free to push for change. Broadcasters, he says, must be, quote, critically involved, a sort of yeast in society. They will be active agents of change, unquote. And he reasserts some of his core beliefs in this Reith lecture. Quote, that it matters to communicate, that one can communicate, and that experience is exchangeable, and that our personal experiences can have a more than personal meaning. This could be banally obvious, or it could be quite profound and actually rather bold to say in the context of a Reith lecture. And interestingly, Hoggart concludes Reith Lecture 6, which is the last one, and which has the interesting title of A Common Ground. I think by now we won't be surprised that that's the kind of title that Hoggart goes for, and that's the kind of approach he's interested in. This is how he concludes it. It's on the slide. The urge to communicate and the idea that experience is shared both rest on the belief that we can, at least sometimes, look at our experiences straight, and on the belief that it is important to tell people about them because other people count as we feel we count ourselves. In other words, this kind of effort at communication rests on a feeling, I call it a fellow feeling, towards others, which is intrinsically different from one which wishes only to use them or manipulate them, or from an ancient mariner's grabbing them by the lapel so as to get something off his chest. A shot of those books on our sitting room floor. Thanks to my husband for that photo. In all Hoggart's cultural writings, there's an emphasis on having a clear argument, and I don't just mean a clear argument oneself in one's own writing, but an argument with everybody else. He never calls on other people to agree with him. All he wants people to do is to be honest in clarifying their own position and in listening to others' positions. And I said already, I think his statements on communication could seem banal if they were taken out of context. But in fact, his recurring themes gently undercut a lot of false assumptions. How many of us would pass the test of writing with stringent honesty, of facing ourselves in writing, of writing without flashiness or manipulation, or the desire to sell something, even if it's only selling ourselves? I'm not sure if I would. How many of us would pass the test of really engaging with the views of others, not just accommodating them, and of reaching the widest possible audience without dilution or obscurity? If you'll forgive me, I'll just finally say a brief word about Hoggart and theory. I know people are probably getting thirsty, but I think this just needs a brief mention. Because although Hoggart's writing is deceptively simple, it doesn't mean it lacks theoretical weight. I wouldn't want people to go away with that impression, because there are, within Hoggart's work, ways of thinking about class and culture which later theory may have lost. I've already talked about the second part of the uses of literacy, where Hoggart analyses examples of popular writing. But the first part of the uses of literacy is it sets the context for that by painting a portrait of the working class. And in this part, Hoggart draws on his own personal experience growing up as a working class boy. And Hoggart's method here, I think, anticipates the methodology of feminist writers of the 1970s, because they also drew on personal experience as a starting point. And possibly also, we could say that the first part one of uses is definitely marked with a strong sense of the importance of rootedness and a sense of place. And I think this also, we could argue, anticipates by several decades the preoccupations recently developed within cultural geography. Stuart Hall has argued that Hoggart's work is not to be located in opposition to Marxism, post-structuralism and other strands of theory, but as the catalyst for their reception into cultural studies. But the first to discern the theoretical weight and the methodological importance of the uses of literacy was French sociologist Jean-Claude Passeron. Passeron wrote the introduction to the French edition of the uses of literacy, La culture du pauvre, in 1970. Passeron established Hoggart's social scientific credentials. He argues that the uses of literacy confronts intellectuals with their own biases. Where British critics might see a weakness in the book's jargon-free style and its grounding in personal experience, it's a sort of empirical method, Passeron sees all these things as a strength. He says the autobiographical element is a strength because it enables Hoggart to give an honest representation of the popular voice in culture and to avoid claims to a specious objectivity typical of bourgeois intellectuals. Passeron is not nobody. He's a very important, distinguished, eminent French sociologist, a collaborator of Pierre Bourdieu, although he later took his distance from Bourdieu. He's director, currently, of the Grande École of Social Sciences, which is an extremely eminent institution. And Passeron discerns a theoretical rigour behind the liveliness of description in Hoggart's writing. He says that the use of literacy has social scientific validity in the tradition of ethnography. And he says that Hoggart's lack of distance is not a strength but a weakness. He says it allows Hoggart to give a more complete picture than an ethnographer could. I may have gone on a bit at length about Passeron there, but I think it just blows my mind that this is this incredible French praise of what might be thought to be British empiricism. It completely challenges our assumptions about directionality of influence. It completely overturns our simplistic idea of British empiricism versus French hypertheoreticism and blows that silly idea out of the water. And Hoggart's ideas continue to find reception in France. There was an overview of French popular culture studies in France by Patrick and Philippe Gaborio, which cites the uses of literacy as one of three key foreign influences on French social sciences, alongside Bakhtin and the Chicago School of Sociology. This gives enormous prestige to Hoggart's ideas. And let's go on to, this is my final, you'll be pleased to hear, slide. David mentioned a rather dense theoretical article I published a few years ago on chaos theory, Marxism and literature, and I felt quite chastened actually to read the following from Hoggart. This is what Hoggart says in his Life and Times about his own relationship to theory. I admire and sometimes use a language of theory which captures concepts irreplaceably. I mistrust the way some people use abstractions as props or crutches, substitutes for thought, ways of showing others and assuring themselves that they belong to an inner group. I suspect anyone who peppers his papers with heuristic, hegemony, hierarchy, paradigm, problematic, reification, homology and the like. One can sometimes work through almost unintelligible and certainly rebarbative papers only to realise at the end that though what they say is sensible and in some ways perceptive, it could have been said almost entirely without that apparatus of in-group theoretical language. And yet we may situate that passage against... Oh, sorry, this is the wrong slide. How stupid. Beg your pardon, sorry. Yet we may situate that passage against a passage from a 1969 work by Hoggart called Contemporary Cultural Studies, where he argues that a society bears values, cannot help bearing values, and deciding their relative significance, that it makes what seems like a significant or ordered whole out of experience, a total and apparently meaningful view of life, and that it embodies these structures of values in systems of meaning, rituals, forms, that it lives out these values expressively in its actions and arts, that this living out of values is a dialectical process, never complete, always subject to innovation and change, and that no one individual ever makes a perfect fit with the dominant order of values of his culture. And as Lawrence Grossberg has pointed out, this is a theoretical position, even if it may not be peppered with heuristic and paradigm and reification and so on. Hoggart dislikes theory for its own sake. He dislikes the use of theory to preempt ground-level analysis. He dislikes the use of theory to as it were, answer questions in advance. He thinks the answers must come from the ground level up. But this does not mean that Hoggart's vision of cultural studies was not theoretically based. And I don't think Hoggart would have approved either of the patronising assumption that ordinary people can't read theory, or that anything addressed to ordinary people must be atheoretical. I'll just put that back because it's nicer to look at than that. I'm going to conclude now, and we can all have a drink. Hoggart doesn't talk about capitalism as such, as far as I know anyway. But his lifelong challenge to the misuse of language to persuade and to sell is effectively a critique of the influence of post-war capitalism on culture. In undermining the idea of literary value, we may have removed a basis for resisting the cultural hegemony of late capitalism. But we can't go back, and most of us don't want to regroup around a conservative or elitist notion of value. Hoggart's ideas may offer a way to resist both complete capitalist domination of culture and the crisis of values. If this critique can't come from arts and humanities departments of universities, then where can it come from? I'd like to end by quoting something Hoggart wrote in his Life and Times about university committees. Quote, "Writers on universities like to assert with satisfaction that university committees are at bottom as ruthless as those in big business or big politics. I have no experience of big business, but some of big politics with the UN, and I know that equivalence is an engaging nonsense. University committees are free from some distorting pressures. Some members do behave like market shysters, but the general conduct is, as it should be, more disinterested than in places where money or politics rule. In other words, we are in a position to try and keep society healthy, even if it may not, no longer be fashionable to say so. And it's up to us to exercise this responsibility. And I think that if we're looking for a revision in troubled times, we could do worse than to embrace this. Thank you.
Very much for a splendid lecture which reminded us how important a figure Richard Hoggart is, but by doing so also addressed many of the still burning issues for us as scholars in the arts and humanities, and reminded us that we have a lot to do still. You've told us an awful lot of what you know, and I know that people here will want to find out even more of what you know, but on these occasions we don't subject our lecturers to formal interrogation on the panel. We instead invite you to continue the conversation over a glass of wine or something alcoholic, if that is your preference. So please do now join us for a drink.